Well, good morning.
Good morning.
And you can see from the size of this book, we have a large agenda. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time speaking other than say good morning. And don't tell me the scores of the soccer matches because I'm recording them for later. And anyone who does, there are troopers there to take you out. And since they're troopers, it's not police brutality if they hit you. So, okay. Madam Treasurer?
Good morning. I was going to go through all the games and the scores.
But there's probably one still playing right now.
I won't do that. I just wanted to mention three things this morning that I think are of particular interest to the Board of Public Works and the folks here. The first was, since it's been 5 weeks since we met last, and the governor, Lieutenant Governor, just mentioned in the other room, Ellicott City and Columbia, that has mm-hmm. happened since we were here last. Mr. Secretary, the Climate Change Commission met yesterday, and clearly our weather, whether you can tie a specific storm and a specific tragedy like that to climate change or not, there's no question it's becoming less stable, and our planning and our adaptation and the resilience of our state and our counties and our cities and our people are going to depend on the actions that are taken here in Annapolis, I believe, in the next short term, few years, before we have to start really building big time. And Secretary Belton's the chair of the mm-hmm. Committee on Resilience and Adaptation of the Climate Change Commission, and I think his group is doing a lot of work. The people don't know enough about the work that is being done. And I think all the folks in this room should know and then be able to talk to all their constituents and all their people out there that they work with and know that things are being done. Much more has to be done, but we're making progress. While we do obviously care so much about the people who have been impacted, the families and the retailers, the folks who are in a particular place, Ellicott City, for instance, we've got to look statewide and make sure that we do all we can to enhance the resiliency of Maryland. That was one. Second was, I was so pleased to see yesterday, I have criticized Governor Hogan about some things in the years past, but the action he took yesterday, recalling Maryland National Guardsmen from New Mexico until this terrible policy a family separation is stopped, I think was such a good mood and another reason to be proud of Maryland. And the third, a sadder one, since we met last, we lost our former colleague Ted Sophocles, with whom both the Comptroller and I served in the General Assembly, a man whom, as Speaker Bush said, had a heart bigger than life. A good person, a person dedicated, whether he was in county government or state government. Jim worked with him, too, in the legislature, and he will be sorely missed, and our sympathies go to his family and to the whole Anne Arundel County community who will miss him, but he lived a very good life, and we appreciate it, and thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for recognizing the Climate Change Commission and Secretary Belton's role. And Secretary Grumbles is very much involved in it as well.
Secretary Grumbles is the co-chair, actually.
Yes. So, thank you for that. And, of course, a lot of credit goes to Howard County's emergency response personnel. The governor and I went out there that evening and actually had to wait till the water receded before we could go down on Main Street. And I had been there the night that 2 years ago, that night, and it actually was worse this past time than it was 2 years ago, particularly in terms of the infrastructure damage that took place. And So it's a real challenge, and a lot of planning has to go into what we can do to divert water from coming down the way it did the other night. Mr. Comptroller, sir.
Yes, thank you. I didn't know the Lieutenant Governor was a soccer fan.
Oh, yeah.
My team in the World Cup this year is Iceland.
Yeah,
I guess
sorry.
They're out, but already, maybe. But,
no, they're not. No, they're not. No, they're right in it. Right in it.
This tiny little country tied Argentina.
And yeah.
I think everybody in the world probably feels sorry for Argentina, but thank you for mentioning the World Cup. It cheered me up. And what's your favorite team?
Germany.
No, I'm rooting for Belgium.
Wow. Okay.
Germany.
They got beat by Mexico.
England.
And Mexico looked better.
That was sad.
England. I like England because I follow the Premier League, but
yes.
I don't think they're going to make it.
Well, the biggest upset in World Cup history was 1950 when a group of amateur American soccer players went over as a kind of pickup team to play in the World Cup and defeated mighty England 1-0. And the team felt so bad for beating England because it was such a humiliating embarrassment that they apparently went over the next day and just kind of tried to comfort the English team. But in the annals of World Cup playing, it is the most shocking result of a match by a long shot. So keep an eye on Iceland, and Lieutenant Governor, thank you. I think that's interesting information, and I'm delighted to hear you're a soccer fan. I just wanted to echo the sentiments of the treasurer about, and frankly, Marylanders and fellow Americans from every part of the nation who are very appalled and confused and unhappy by the Trump administration's treatment of migrant children and their families. And I think what's most disconcerting for Americans is that the White House seems to enjoy their position. Everyone seems to be, this is good. We're showing strength with zero tolerance. Reports of high fives at the staff in the White House. This has nothing to do, in my opinion, with being a liberal or a conservative or about one's views on immigration or what party you're in or whether you like Trump or don't like Trump. This is just a matter of basic, fundamental human decency. And what we're seeing down on the border is nothing short of an American disgrace. We have a nation of laws. We fought, defended fundamental values and principles. And those values and principles are, frankly, being desecrated right now. It's time for all of us, Democrats and Republicans alike, to come together as Americans and speak out about the harsh, heartless tactics. And I commend members of Congress, several of them, Elijah Cummings, who was on the news last night, and also Chris Van Hollen, our U.S. Senator, who went down to Texas. My wife wants me to get on a plane and go down there. That's how, and she's very level-headed, normal person. But you know what I'm talking about. People want this policy stopped, and they do not buy the lies, really, that this is somehow a Democratic responsibility on the Democrats. It's just wrong, and the president should pick the phone up. In 5 minutes, he could call it off. I want to especially salute Governor Hogan because he is a Republican, yet he's come out with a policy that not only is something where he speaks out against this mistake that has been forced on the country, but he actually did something in pulling back the helicopter and the four guardsmen. And I think the fact that the governor of Virginia, Democrat, and the governor of North Carolina, Republican, did the same thing, is, hats off to them. Hats off to all of the governors, Republican and Democrat, who have stood up. Because obviously when you do that, if you're a Republican, you risk becoming the target. That's the deputy director. deputy secretary.
Still.
Yeah.
Soon to be former. Soon to be former.
Yeah. So I want to just applaud the elected officials, particularly Republicans who are standing up, because obviously this president takes great pleasure in inflicting punishment on people that, where he can, and he does it frequently. So it's not easy for Republicans to stand up and say this is wrong, but they're doing the right thing. Frankly, I cannot fathom the idea that anyone would use as a bargaining chip separating toddlers and infants from their parents. I can't imagine what kind of trauma that inflicts upon those young, innocent individuals who are alone and seemingly abandoned in a cramped jail cell. Those of you that saw the 6-year-old repeating her aunt's phone number, pleading that someone call her aunt. Really? Traveled 2,000 miles from Guatemala, and she's crying for her parents, and she's memorized. It's the only thing she has in her head is the phone number of her aunt in Brownsville, Texas. So I assume that it's going to come to an end because this is the United States of America, and there is one individual that controls this. Change it immediately. And I assume that there is some sense of responsibility somewhere in these heartless actions, and that this decision, hopefully today, will be reversed. Thank you, Lieutenant Governor.
Thank you. Well, thank you and Treasurer for recognizing, you know, Governor's courageous move. With that, we'll turn to the Secretary's agenda.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. We have 32 items on your action-packed agenda this morning. We have 8 reports of emergencies. Item 32 is a hand-carried item, which, if approved, will authorize a bond sale on August the 1st. We are withdrawing items 2 and 29. What are your questions?
There's an emergency item, A2, that I just wanted to point out, a typo.
Okay.
So since this is going to be a long meeting, I want to point to every typo and grammatical error.
All right, well, I think I'm going to take it on the chin for this one.
No, we don't need anyone to talk about it. Just,
and I think it's my typo because I probably edited this for them.
Just,
can I just mention, Governor, right there? It's my understanding that the board will be meeting 1 week later or 8 days later than usual.
Are you agreeing to that date? Yes. I mean, okay.
All right. So
we haven't told anybody because we were waiting.
Well,
for
the reason I'm saying that is just I want to make it clear that the bond issue, item 32,
okay,
was hand-carried in order to be able to advertise the sale at an appropriate time. It should be approved today. It's quite candidly a lot of the language you've seen before. It's mm-hmm. the same language. It's for approximately $500 million in new money. Since we can't do refundings anymore, courtesy of the United States Congress and President, by the way, our state made over $350 million that taxpayers gained because of refunding since they were first elected. They killed that, unless we can get it back again. But the bond sale is not changing. The terms of the bonds are not changing. But we have brought it for approval today instead of 2 weeks from now.
Correct.
Okay.
Just to make sure it's there. So I just don't want anybody to think because it's hand-carried there's anything
Thank you.
If I could just mention, along with the bond sale, thank you, Madam Treasurer, for shepherding that. We will be voting today on $1.7 billion in taxpayers' money. We're not authorizing. We're not legislating. We are actually voting on approving the contracts for the expenditure of $1.7 billion. So every once in a while, I kid people, I put my hand down in the seat cushion and there's a couple $100,000 there. This is a wealthy state we're in, and there's tremendous resources. And today is just one of whatever it is, 26 meetings during the year of this board. And I think we average $450 million at each meeting over the year, but this is a particularly large amount of projects. And
well, being a relatively, if not completely cheap guy, don't remind me of how much money was spent.
I was wondering why the lieutenant governor got picked to.
Yeah, that's my punishment, I think. I do want to reference number 11 on the secretary's agenda. Natural Resources, Chesapeake Atlantic, Coastal Bay Trust. And I'm only referencing it from the standpoint of the grant to Parks and People Foundation, which do an extremely good job. And I want to say, if anyone is here from Parks and People, I did get the invitation to the Ambrose Kennedy Park opening, but I won't be able to attend, so that's kind of an announcement. I think I already sent a RSVP, not able to attend that. Item 23 is Morgan State. I see Dr. Wilson and Chief Financial Officer. Can you come up and talk about Morgan State Northwood Common?
Good morning, Lieutenant Governor Rutherford, Treasurer Kopp, and Comptroller Frenchko. I'm very pleased to be here this morning to talk about a project that Morgan State University has been working on for several years, indeed for decades. And it almost is coming to fruition, and so I just want to take a couple of minutes and give you a brief recapitulation of it, and then I and my Chief Finance Officer are here to address any details that you have. Morgan is indeed an anchor institution in the city of Baltimore. The state legislature last year signed into law, Governor Hogan signed into law, a bill designating Morgan as Maryland's preeminent public urban research university. We are taking that destination very, very seriously and are looking at the role that we will play in economic development and community development in the area in which we are anchored. You may have read that we released the very first economic and social impact study of Morgan State University, basically concluding that Morgan has a $1 billion economic impact in the state of Maryland, $584 million of that in Baltimore City. And so we are indeed taking very, very seriously our anchor status and the role of Morgan as the urban preeminent public research university. With that said, we have a shopping center that literally is on our campus. It literally is. You step off the campus here and you step on the campus of the shopping center. And over the decades, it has deteriorated. It has become a site of crime. It is an eyesore of the highest order. And so about 6 years ago, I started having conversations with the owners of that center, say, here's the vision for Morgan, and show me the vision for the center, because we are moving in different directions, and we want our neighborhoods and our communities to move along with us, and we're living in a desert, there's no place to get food, there's no place for students or neighbors or residents to go and get anything. And so the vision that came forward initially was one that, quite frankly, was not in comportment with the vision of Morgan, and where we wanted to see the institution go, especially given the investments that the state had made in us and the buildings that we had erected on that site. And so we went through a period of back and forth where finally a vision came forward that we felt was certainly in the best interest of all of the neighborhoods that abut the campus and also in comportment with the direction that Morgan was taking. And so with that in mind, we have been engaged in dialogue to partner with the developers of that particular Northwood Shopping Center. And the partnership will be a two-pronged partnership. The first part of it is where we will be leasing a facility in that shopping center once everything is raised and it is going to be completely redeveloped to move our on-campus bookstore to that site where for the very first time it would be a co-branded bookstore. We sent out an RFP, and Barnes & Noble actually won that RFP, and they will actually run the bookstore for us on that site. This is similar to what you see at the University of Baltimore, at Johns Hopkins, and some other institutions that have gone down this path. The bookstore will have in it a cafe, a Starbucks cafe, and gathering amenities for our students. In essence, the students are very excited now that we are able to bring literally to them amenities that students on other campuses have had for years. The second part of the partnership will involve the building of a public safety building on the campus. Our police officers are now housed in dilapidated, outdated facilities, and this is an opportunity for us also to build on that site a new space for our police facilities. But today, item 23 is one where we are asking the Board of Public Works approval for the lease between Morgan State University and the developers that will commence this partnership in earnest. And I'll stop there and see what questions you have that either I or Sydney Evans, our Vice President for Finance and Management, may be able to address.
Before we get to the lease itself, can you talk a little bit about, and this may be somewhat, you know, self-serving because I'm very much, you know, interested in the development and the redevelopment of the whole center, to talk about what the concept is that the that you've had discussions with the community, with the owners for the shopping center that will become, you know, Northwood Commons versus Northwood Shopping Center.
Yes, and that's a great segue, Lieutenant Governor, for me to also express my appreciation to you and your leadership for your involvement in this project, for Senator John Carter Conway's leadership, and for others that have actually played a role in bringing it to this point. The concept is one where we will have a number of shops over there now and restaurants that the community has said this is also going to serve the needs of the community in addition to the needs of Morgan State University. Indeed, we went through a period of about 4 years where we brought the community on board with us, because initially we were looking at a multi-use development with student housing above retail. But that really did not go over very well with the community. And then we went back to the drawing board and we rethought the concept in a way that would still achieve these goals that I spoke about earlier. And so what the developer has now put on the table is that there are soft commitments now for a number of restaurants in the first phase. There will be a new pharmacy that will be built on that space in the first phase. And also McDonald's, an old dilapidated facility there. They are raising that and building a new store closer to Loch Raven. And so that entire site that you see now, called Northwood, will be raised, and there will be a town center concept. In essence, there will be retail on both sides of that town center instead of a quote-unquote strip mall. In the second phase, I have met with the developer with several potential supermarkets that would be interested in anchoring the second phase, and so we are very hopeful that in the second phase that will happen. And I think the developer is also having discussions with a 24-hour urgent care facility that will be there as well. And so these are amenities that that neighborhood, or those neighborhoods, have just simply not had there in 60 years, since the old Hex supermarket was there, and the ice cream parlor and all that dating back to the 1950s and 1960s.
Thank you.
Could I just urge you, we were discussing earlier climate change and remember the discussions of permeability, impermeability, et cetera. When you look at these plans, particularly since it's going to be a community center as well as a center for the university, to put green where you can, to make it a pleasant place, the potential is so great. And looking at the plans, I mean, you've got a lot to work with there. And I think it just could be a wonderful model of very comfortable urban living that fits so well with the Morgan campus, which, as you know, I've always thought was just a beautiful campus. I just urge you.
But
to urge
are
them.
The owners. Right.
And we would certainly urge the owners to heed those suggestions, because this is in comportment with what we have embraced at Morgan in terms of sustainability. When you look
right.
at our new buildings, of course, we have green roofs, and,
right.
And they are qualified for LEED certification. And so we also are looking at our
yeah.
campus with regard to sustainability and lowering the carbon footprint.
So they build something that not only provides good services, but does it in a way that makes it look like Morgan, I think.
I hear you.
Could I just say one thing about the lease? We've discussed this, as you know, Mr. President. There is a process that we have to go through to determine whether something is an operating lease or a capital lease. And it makes a difference both in reporting and in the process that's required for approval. And to make sure that we get both the development that we want and do it properly in terms of this process, I have an amendment that we've shared. And I would like to propose, and I hope and believe you all agree with. And let me just say, if this turns out to be an operating lease, which, in fact, you didn't have to bring to us, I appreciate very much the fact that you did bring it to us, because it's good news to share this development. But the amendment reads, this approval is conditioned upon receipt by the treasurer of documentation, which, in the treasurer's sole discretion, demonstrates that the lease does not constitute a lease meeting the criteria set forth in Section 12204D1 of the Senate of the State Finance and Procurement article of the Annotated Code. That's simply the article that describes a capital lease as opposed to an operating lease. The lease may not be executed by Morgan until such time as the treasurer has made the determination that satisfactory documentation has been provided. If it turns out that it's an operating lease, that's it. If it turns out that it's a capital lease, there's a process that we'll go through, and I assume in the end we will have the development that we all want. But I hope this language is you find appropriate, and the governor and comptroller as well.
This doesn't interfere with your financing and the project. I know that was a concern early on.
We don't think that it will. We have provided the documentation. We'll provide additional documentation. I think there's a timing issue, and I see no reason why the decision here could not be made in an expedited manner so we can get back with the developer and not hold up the finance.
But you do understand we didn't get the information until 3:30 or 4 yesterday
That's
afternoon,
correct.
And it does take some time to go
okay.
through it.
That is correct.
I just want to thank the president for his eloquent support, but I notice you have an iconic figure in the room, a member of your Board of Regents.
Yes.
And I wonder if Mr. Resnick could come up for a second, because if he says it's okay, it's okay with me.
Yeah. Oh, it is.
Morning.
Good morning. Welcome home.
It's a pleasure to be here with all of you here, and I'm sorry to get so much of time from everybody here who's here not to hear me speak or be honored today, and I appreciate the fact I am here today to be amongst this board, the members of this board.
Well, we do want to, you know, recognize your long service to Morgan State University, as well as being a founding member of the University System Foundation, as well as Morgan State's foundation, and the fact that you, it's been announced, I guess, that you'll be retiring from the board. But we have a governor's citation for you. And
oh,
right on cue.
Yeah.
Governor, can I just say Mr. Resnick, we went through a lot of turmoil about 20 or 30 years ago in creating the system, the University System of Maryland, and establishing the role of Morgan as the urban university. And I don't think it would have gone through without your support and the creation of the foundation, which has meant so much. So I just want to publicly acknowledge that.
Thank you. Martin Resnick greetings. Be it known that on behalf of the citizens of this state, in recognition of our grateful appreciation for your 35 years of outstanding service as a valued member of the Morgan State University Board of Regents, and as the people of Maryland join together in expressing our best wishes and sincere congratulations for your more than three decades of successful service to our state, we are pleased to confer upon you this governor's citation signed this day, Lawrence J. Hogan, Governor Jr., myself, or Governor Jr., myself, Boyd Rutherford, and the Secretary of State, John C. Wilson. Thank you.
Wayne to come up, his son, and just everyone knows who wants to know who's running the business staff or helping.
Okay,
Wayne, come on up. Yep.
Thank you. I could say a few words.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you all very much. I appreciate the wonderful honor you've given me this evening, this morning. My 35 years on the board have made me realize several good things. The fact that what the board has accomplished and what over the last 35 years, and how proud I am of Morgan State University has developed into over these many years. Probably things I'm most proud of is not only the university growing the way it has and the way that the campus has grown, but also the way the staff has grown, the number of the students have grown. But equally, I'm just impressed with the fact that myself, that I appreciate the most, the job that I did the most was when I was chairman of the selection committee 37 years ago to bring in our new president, and that was Earl Richardson. But the thing that gave me pride is the fact that just 4 or 5 years ago, on the same committee, to bring a new president to the university, and I was very happy that David Wilson was that member that we chose to that board. So I think I've done two wonderful things for our university, if nothing else, for bringing in heads of the university who made the university what it is today. And without those heads, two men, it just wouldn't have happened the way it is today. And thank you very much.
First of all, not a few, Mr. President.
Okay. Oh, thank you.
Thank you. We do look forward to hearing, we'll be working closely together to hearing how the project develops. It's really very exciting.
And we will be bringing back the second part of the partnership when we get to the public safety building, and that perhaps could be at the next meeting of the Board of Public Works.
Thank you.
A motion to amend was approved to amend that item. And so when we do the, I just want to make sure the motion to amend
that we
right. Okay, so that is the motion that will be in front of you.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
DHCD has two projects.
Which numbers?
7 and 8, which I think are worth just pointing out. 7, Malta House. I was hoping you would. I didn't see you. Mr. Secretary, the Malta House, we're putting money into developing solar energy, a solar array, which we talked about earlier models. Here's another model of ways that we can improve both the buildings that we own and that we work with, the lives of the people and the economy. And I just want to thank you. This is not the first time you've brought in a solar project, but...
Thank
but
you.
I just think it should be noted.
Okay. Well, I'll accept your thanks. And John Manable is here. He can give you some details about the project. But I can only say that we have an energy division is really intent about looking into the cutting edge technology for development in our multifamily units. And I think we've been very successful and will continue to be so.
I think it shows leadership on the right things, I believe, Mr. Secretary. Thank you. I had another question about the next item, item eight. I'm sorry, the second item, Neighborhood Business Development Program. Great project. I have no problem with the project at all. But I am curious about the elasticity of the program itself. This, as I read it, what you told us, is mostly residential with some retail on the first floor. This program, I think, was instituted originally, at least, for business development. And it does develop business because it's bringing people in who will patronize businesses. I get that. But it's sort of an indirect way. Has there been a development in the program that extends it beyond what we traditionally think of as business development to just general community development?
Yeah, so this is a great question. Our Neighborhood Business Works program is a business lending program, as you pointed out. The legislature sort of increased our capability to loan up to $50 million annually to sort of leverage our dollars or state dollars in a greater way. What we've found is that this model where residential and retail or commercial are sort of combined together is a very, very good model. And we're layering in a kind of mezzanine financing different capital sources that complement each other. So the Neighborhood Business Works could be supported by other state-funded programs that are basically residentially driven. And in doing so, I think we create that kind of economic driver that is so important. Thibault Mannequin in Baltimore, the Remington Project, is probably a very good example of sort of taking workforce housing, housing that can support teachers and firefighters and law enforcement, and build in and around it a commercial hub that they can patronize. So our house, as it sort of supports the Remington population, is a great example of how these two things can work in a kind of a symbiotic way. So, John, I don't know whether you have any additional thoughts.
John Manable, DHCD. Madam Treasurer, I'll just add that the program has for a long time embraced the mixed-use development concept, and as the Secretary indicated, we've done several of these over the year as well. And, as you yourself pointed out, bringing residents in, complements the street-level retail, so we think that's a really good symbiotic relationship. We're also leveraging significant private capital in this project, so we're taking state money, amplifying it by bringing in capital, in this case, from Harbor Bank. So we, really kind of hit all the boxes with a project like this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Second.
Huh. We're all in favor.
I was waiting for another question. May I say something
with
about the meeting? No, we will get it all
with
the amendment. About because there's something the Treasurer said about the hand-carried item that might intrigue people. So we are postponing the – if you're here in the crowd or you're watching on the Internet, you'll be the first to hear. We are postponing the July 11th meeting, which is the next meeting. The July 11th meeting is rescheduled to Thursday, July 19th. That will be on the Internet. Everybody's on our list. You have Maryland.gov delivery. All that will go out to you this afternoon. But you're the first person to hear it that the next meeting will be Thursday, July 19th.
Okay.
Thank you.
For all those viewing at home. Okay. So we've approved Secretary's agenda, Department of Natural Resources.
Good morning, Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Mark Belton, the Secretary of the Maryland Department of Natural Resources, and we have 22 items on our real property agenda for your approval this morning.
I don't have any questions.
No, other than a comment, I just hope, Mr. Secretary, that you can work with the administration and come up with some kind of plan to keep the Sailing Hall of Fame in Maryland, since it's about to pick up and move north, and that would be not good for the Annapolis region. So I know you're in the middle of some, or maybe, or whatever, but whatever it is that's happening that will help expedite this, I hope you'll bring it to the next July 19th, the July 19th meeting, or try to.
Well, we certainly are working very closely with them as well as the administration on that.
Because otherwise they're going to be gone. And, you know, we'll say, oh, gee, sailing capital of the world doesn't have the Hall of Fame Museum for sailing. And anyway, thank you for, I know you're involved in this somehow, so thank you for paying attention to it.
Yeah, we want them to stay, but it's one of those things, not at any price. And that's where the negotiation takes place. Yeah. Any other questions on
move approval?
Okay, we're all in favor. Budget and management. Department of Budget and Management.
Good morning. For the record, David Brinkley, the Secretary of the Department of Budget and Management, Lieutenant Governor, Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer. We have submitted 31 items for your consideration, but I'm withdrawing item 2S, leaving 30 for your consideration. I have representatives here to address any questions you might have. Items 12S, OPT, has been revised, and item 31, GM, is supplemental.
All right. I have a question on 5S.
Dana?
The Medicaid program.
Okay. Dana Dembro?
Could they be out?
I think they would have to have the text.
Okay.
Well, it's just the question is really there's so much of a difference between the financial. I just didn't understand. You know, the other was technically, and can they really do the job for this? This price difference.
I understood in my briefing with this that they were all, while there's a 1-4 category on the technical side, they all were still very high in the ability to do this. When Dana gets here, he might be able to go into that a little bit further. Therefore, the determination was made to go with that one.
If there are other questions, we can come back to. Oh, there's Dana.
There he is.
There he is.
There he is.
Welcome.
Thank you. Large crowd out there.
Okay.
Dana, the question that
was, the Dana. My name is Dana Dembro, Director of Procurement for the Department of Health. I understand we're on item 5S.
Yes.
Regards from Deputy Secretary of Medicaid, Dennis Schrader. He is busy doing some IT work.
Catch your breath.
Tell
you what his question was, and that will allow you to catch up here.
Okay.
And it had to deal with the technical ranking, how I guess number 4 became the preferred one. And my understanding from my briefing yesterday was that there really wasn't a whole lot of distinction, though there was a ranking, that they were all qualified to that extent, and therefore we got to where they are. Now, maybe my briefing was a little bit off in that. You certainly know the details of it, but I want to allow you a chance to catch your breath.
And before you go on, I know in some circles on the federal level, they look at what is called the lowest technically acceptable. And so they hit that and then go to a low bid. And I'm just hoping that that's not what we did here.
What we did here is exactly what Secretary Brinkley was indicating. We are saving the taxpayers $166,000. That's a 67% difference between the higher technically ranked proposer, HMA, and the fourth ranked technical proposer, Public Consulting Group. They demonstrated that they were capable of doing this job. So it came to a question, do you want to spend $1 million or more, or can we get the job done for $250,000? This is under our budget. And we were fully convinced that they are competent
How
to do
the
work.
How did you weigh the technical versus the, did you give 60% and you have points, and then when you add up the points, that's who it goes to?
They were equivalent. And I will tell you, I told the
They were equivalent. One was 4 and one was 1.
I'm sorry, the technical
and, oh, it was 50-50.
Technical
okay.
and the financial were equivalent weights. Uh-huh. And when okay. they ranked the technical, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and saw that there was a difference between 1 and 4, of $166,000, I challenge the evaluation committee, tell me why it's worth $166,000 more to hire HMA, which is the top-ranked technical. And they tried, and they came to the conclusion unanimously, we can't do it. We need to save the taxpayers this money and go with a company that is fully qualified, that will charge us a great deal less than a competitor.
Well, they better be able to do the work without any changes, because that process we'd have to take a closer look at. I'm not sure that that is something we typically like to do, because it does ring to the lowest technically acceptable, which, unless the, and I don't, I'm not going to go any further because it could lead to some challenges. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I have a question, number 17, DGS's energy performance contract, and really just a straight question, Mr. Secretary. We asked a number of questions, and your department was very forthcoming and very helpful, and I appreciate it. And one was whether the information allows the state to identify and disseminate best practices to help state agencies reduce utility consumption. And part of your response was yes. But we're also involved in a project to collect missing data from agencies on building size, age, and primary use in order to make the database more complete. And I know we're going to have a meeting soon, but I'm really curious about that statement, how big the gap is, how much we need to fill in the database to make it as useful as you all and we believe that it could be. And how you can really implement best practices if we don't know everything we have.
Sure. There are some missing data that we have identified that will help us do our analysis of our energy program. I would ask, in terms of the data that is missing, that Lauren Buckler, Assistant Secretary for Facilities Planning, Design, Construction, and Energy, address your question.
Yeah, I don't mean to take up a lot of time right now, although I'm delighted to hear something, but look forward to being filled in. Obviously, the project's good. I have no issue with the project. And also a request that you work with our insurance division, which does, as you know, have a rundown of a lot of our buildings, all the ones that are insured at any rate. And maybe there could be some useful synergy.
In answer to your question, our energy department has gone through some transitions, and when we looked at the program and the data that we were compiling, there were some glaring omissions, as we've said, that should have been just common sense things to calculate. So we're going to have to do some data collection on that, but it's fairly simple to do.
The pretty quick answer, I'm Lauren Buckler, Assistant Secretary for Department of General Services, is that the data is very focused around the utility bill situation right now. So it's great when we purchase electricity for us to get really low rates. It's perfect for that. When we start looking at things like retrocommissioning, which we're digging into right now, we end up with some gaps that we can clear working with the Treasurer's Insurance Division, gaps on square footage, things like that, where we start looking at energy use indexes and which buildings to target. But the data is fantastic when we do energy purchasing. So we're trying to close those gaps.
And that was, I understand, the original purpose. But now, as you know, we're into this question of adaptation resilience. This is part of that.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question about item 12S?
Secretary Moyer and Deputy Secretary William Stewart and Anna Lansall, Director of Procurement.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Secretary, and your staff. So my question is, this is for inmate pharmacy services, this contract extension for 3 months?
Yes, sir.
My question is, why is it so difficult to conduct a competitive procurement? This is an item that I believe the incumbent first started working on this in 2005. They have held the contract for 13 years. We have approved at the Board of Public Works 12 extensions. Taxpayers have paid $451 million to this vendor since they were brought on in 2005. I happen to like the company. I think Ellen Yanklow, the CEO, is a very capable corporate leader. And I believe the treasurer and I supported back in 2012 not awarding the contract to a different vendor in the face of their protest. I think I have that right, but whatever.
That was 6 years ago.
6 years ago. I understand you have a lot of questions, apparently, that have been addressed to your staff about the RFP, which was released in June, last June, but it's a mystery to me about why this is so hard to resolve.
Governor Rutherford, Comptroller Francia, and Treasurer Kopp, appreciate the question. There's been 19 modifications. I've been in this job for 42 months. Out of those 19 modifications, we've only been here three times. We did put this together. There was 288 questions. There's been one modification, which resulted in the due date being extended to June 26, 2018. Jamie is here from DEM, who's actually managing the RFP, if there's any additional information.
Good morning, Jamie Tomaszewski, Chief of Procurement for the Department of Budget and Management. DBM has the procurement officer that is handling the solicitation and helping out the Department of Public Safety. The process has taken longer than anticipated because of the number of questions and trying to get the contract specifications to where it is open and fair and transparent and hopefully getting competition. So we've gotten questions from several vendors, and there's currently a protest on the specs. So we're in the process of answering that protest to hopefully continue with the solicitation.
Okay. Well, what we want is a fair and competitive and transparent competition. And the Lieutenant Governor is really the expert on procurement reform, and I know there are a number of things that we will be looking at, et cetera. But fundamentally, we just want a system where people can clearly compete on a level playing field.
Right.
And up in New York, they've got a huge scandal in the state of New York over people that get into the agencies from the outside and suggest amendments to the RFP that tilt it in the favor, their favor, or against the, you know, it's a very dark kind of situation up there in New York, and I'd hate to have this go on too much longer. So I assume at the end of 3 months you're going to have a more clear situation.
That is the goal. We do know we will have to come back to the board again for another extension because we may get the proposals in by that time, but I don't, you know, we will not have had time for the evaluation committee to review the proposals submitted. But the goal that we're looking for with this 3 month option that's available is to answer the protest, make the amendments that are necessary that maintain the integrity of the RFP to be fair and competitive so that we can get the proposals in, because we want to give time to the offerers to have time to respond to the corrected RFP once that is done.
I'm going to defer to the Lieutenant Governor on this because it is we want to get it resolved so it doesn't continue to linger.
Right. I know. And so thankfully, CorrectRx has worked with us to continue their services for the state during this time that we've had to procure. And being an MBE, we do have 100% MBE participation along with the subcontracting that she does as well. So.
Well, since you brought that up, what is this 39% goal that apparently in 10 years, according to the documents, has only had a 7% compliance? Is that?
That's been since the contract was modified for the extension beyond the original five-year contract period. So the service fee that was being charged by the contractor changed. So the work has not changed during that period. So the work provided by the MBEs continues to be consistent for their MBEs, but the contractor is making more money than originally on the base term of the contract.
Okay. Well, we have given them hundreds of millions, paid them hundreds of millions of dollars for the inmate service pharmacy contract. Appreciate that, but the payments to MBE subs are less than they were 10 years ago. $291,000 in 2018 versus $317,000 in 2008. So maybe you could bring that up with the incumbent. If my figures are right, or if my figures are not right, please correct me. I'm happy to give you this.
Yeah, the overall MBE totals starting during the original contract ran from about $300,000 up to $400,000. And then they've been consistently around $300,000 to $400,000 during. So it's basically the same, you know, fluctuates as the amount of pharmacy drugs provided have changed and being. Their MBE does transportation, so they're transporting basically the same amount of drugs back and forth to the facilities. Did I answer your question?
Well, no, I guess the question is, what is the explanation for not being closer to the 39% goal that they agreed to? I understand it's a woman-owned business. That's great. But the subcontractors, they made a commitment on and are not coming through.
Well, the subcontractors are doing the same work. But the amount of money for the fees for the prime contractor have increased. So initially they were running about $93,000 a month for fees. As of 2011, it was almost $690,000 a month for fees. So that base number has increased during the extension period. So the MBEs are the same, $300,000. But the fee that is collected by the prime has increased.
Yeah. Well, I like the company, obviously, and I think they do a good job, but competitive bids are the...
Yeah, we want to get competition and make sure that we're getting good pricing and good quality services.
I think there are you know, two things that the comptroller raised, and that's something to look at with the procurement, but also to the incumbent. Is that their revenue, as you said, with the modifications, their revenue has gone up substantially. Since 2010, it's climbed to the point where they're up over, $54 million last year, and year to date, or at least through April of the 18 fiscal year, $61 million. And so they still have the same subs there. It would be incumbent, if they're trying to reach a goal, to find more subs to do some work. So, okay. All right, thank you, and we'll be watching.
Thank you.
Thank you, Governor.
I don't know if anyone's here from Delmarva Community Services. I'm just recognizing the good work that they do if they're not here, but just appreciate all the work that they do, primarily in Dorchester, but I know they're doing some work in Caroline County. I have a quick question on 23S Ahmad with the Maryland Public Television.
Linda Taggart, Vice President of Development. Daniel Guthrie, the Procurement Officer.
Good morning, Lieutenant Governor Rutherford, Secretary Knopf, and Controller Franchot. My name is Dan Guthrie, Procurement Officer with Maryland Public Television. Linda Taggart.
Vice President of Development. Please forgive my voice.
Okay. Well, thank you. I guess the question I have has to do with this is a modification, and I guess it's a fundraising. Contract that you have.
Yes.
And how much revenue do you get for the money you spent? And that's what I was questioning.
Now we bring in $2.4 million.
Okay, and the cost associated with that is 1.9, is it?
Yes, sir.
Okay, 2.41, and so it's less than 50 cents on the dollar, right? I went to law school, not a math major, but it sounds like fundraising, I know, and, you know, we do a little fundraising, and our jobs is, you know, to get reelected, and mail is an expensive route to take.
Yes, and we are exploring, we also doing email fundraising as well. But our membership base is a little older, they're more mature seasoned, and email hasn't quite grown.
Red eyes, lack of hair. But less than 50 cents on a dollar is pretty tough. You may want to, like I said, just shift another way, because that's, I know that, you know, mail is expensive, but that is difficult. Okay, that's what I was trying to get through, the cost of the mailing, and it just didn't seem to be. Okay. All right. Maybe the comptroller has some great ideas.
No, I'm just, right, my check is in the mail.
you didn't do it online?
But is your president here or not?
No, yes, sir.
Give him my best. He's doing a good job.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Question briefly about 27, the fleet management, which is basically just a reapproval of fiscal 18. Yesterday, at the Climate Change Commission meeting, the Department of Environment's representative, not the secretary, but Tad, said that the most important thing in transportation is electrification. The key, and that we were doing everything we could to support battery charging and all the things that we hope maybe we'll get some VW money to go to all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. Is that reflected at all in our fleet management program or expectations? Or vehicles we have.
I don't know if we have the charging stations.
These are ones we control. We
can
be a model.
Yeah, well,
go
ahead.
Like you said, the VW model.
Good afternoon. Jamie Thomas, Chaplain, Chief of Procurement. I may not be able to get to the answer specifically today because we've just recently hired our new fleet administrator. But I know we are changing within those vehicle types. We have more different types of vehicles.
Well, available. It may be more than just having them on a list. It may involve some leadership. I don't know. All I know is that there are other departments of state government which seem to think this is a key to making progress.
Good morning, Treasurer, Lieutenant Governor, Comptroller. I'm Joe Consoli. I'm the fleet administrator for the state of Maryland. I just hired this as Jamie. She told me that. So our specifications, vehicle specs each year, are designed to address all vehicle needs throughout the state of Maryland, through all the different government agencies. So they have the ability to purchase electric vehicles, plug-in hybrids, you name it, they have the assortment there.
That's super, but it takes more than just, I believe, having them on the list. I appreciate that. And you just arrived.
No, I know. We urge them to purchase where necessary, where they can.
But it's got to go beyond boiler. I mean, there's got to be some passion involved. I think if this is the key or a key to progress, then we have to walk the walk as well as talk.
Agreed.
Okay.
I don't think anyone disagrees, really.
And I'll point out that some of the Volkswagen money that we've used is to be focused on replacing some existing diesel vehicles, which we don't have any in the predominantly the small vehicular fleet, automobiles and things like that. So we were looking at that.
that with some of the port operations, because we do have diesel operations there. So there are some restrictions on how that can be utilized in what we're doing, but we're also using it toward the Department of the Environment in helping us with some other monitoring and some aspects of that. So that part of it wouldn't be applicable to our fleet.
I would just suggest, I mean, MDOT is,
we are,
is pushing
we're looking
that.
At, we're looking at the airport also, along with the port, and you know we had to just had the Green Conference, the International
Green
Conference.
Ports.
First time in North America, we hosted at the port. And also some of the, if I'm not mistaken, some of the VW money is going to some of those charging stations.
That's what
also.
I think, yeah.
It is. My understanding is it is. That it falls under the other.
I read
it
in
so
paper. But I,
more than that.
But I just think that
that's
this is something that
to
we could
electric
do.
Vehicles more viable is the infrastructure behind it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's necessary. Right.
Right.
I visited San Francisco recently, and there are thousands of electric scooters
yes.
all over the city. Apparently, they it's like there's
yeah.
a business model there. And
Los
I just
Angeles too.
Had an image of the lieutenant governor, the treasurer, and me on an electric scooter. That's coming
yeah.
over.
The
but they don't work
friend.
Well in the rain, though. That's the only
thing.
No, really,
Morella.
They said that. They
yeah,
oh, yeah.
Connie Morella drove an electric car when she ran against us in 1974. She didn't win then. She came back and won again. But this is not a new thing. I mean, this is, and Governor?
Well, we can, well, we can look at it, you know, for, you know, some of the vehicles that are used by, you know, some of the regulatory people and just, you know. First of all, I think we have too many state vehicles anyway, but that's another story. But, you know, for some of the, like, non-law enforcement, I think might make sense. So, thank you.
Thank you.
We can look,
and
you know, we
when
can
it's not electrical, fuel efficient.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Oh, wait a minute. There was one more. Are we to talk about the transfer? Item 31. Do you have anyone here from Department of Agriculture? Well, if not, item 31 is a transfer from the contingency fund for the Department of Agriculture and a small portion for the Housing Community Development Rural Assistance deficiency. But mainly the Department of Agriculture, $375,000, is to help in the marketing of seafood, given that we have a visa restriction associated with crab pickers. And so we want to make sure that we're still marketing, that you can get seafood, you can get crabs, that you know, Maryland continues to be a seafood destination and have a viable seafood industry. So I just want to mention that. But we've already
Move approval.
Second. All in favor? Thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have any people leaving? We'll give them a few moments before starting the university.
Thank you.
Yeah,
his
video is out there. Isn't working.
Okay,
close. So,
I'm
trying to
do
it.
Did they go?
Did they
go?
I'm trying to.
Sure.
I think you set yourself up for protests when you said that you weigh in on 50-50 and then you said I'm taking it. But he wanted to. morning.
Good morning. Joe Evans, representing the University System of Maryland. We have 16 items on the agenda. Do you have any questions?
If I could just ask about item one, if I could, Mr. Evans. This is the item that was deferred at the May 2nd meeting. It's a $560,000 contract for exterior artwork to a Florida-based vendor. I made the point then that Maryland has some of the best artists in the country, and it surprised me that out of 200 artists that responded to the request for qualifications, only 12, or 6%, were from Maryland. Of the 44 artists reviewed, only 4 were Maryland-based. These figures underscore my concern that insufficient outreach was conducted with our local artist community in Maryland. So I'm surprised that it's back before us.
Before I bring up Lisa Pfizer, who is with the Art Council, this procurement did follow the regular procurement process. I mean, it was advertised in the Maryland marketplace. This is not the first one that's been done. The evaluation process is the regular evaluation process we go through to vet those vendors, or in this case would be the artists. And then the evaluation committee look at the ones and they try to pick what's considered the best art. So I think it was vetted that we did go through email the marketplace to advertise this requirement like we've done other ones.
Yeah, but less than 10% of the people that replied were from Maryland, and only 4 of the 44 artists reviewed were Maryland-based, and that's ridiculous.
But as far as replying, sir, I mean, we can't make them submit proposals. I mean, if it's out there for them to bid and the notice is out there, we can't make them submit proposals. I would see, you know, Lisa, to see if there was any other additional outreach.
Good morning. Hi. Yes, my name is Lisa Spenner. I'm the Public Art Program Director at the Maryland State Arts Council. I have run the Maryland Public Art Initiative for 3 years. We have run our calls to artists through this standard procurement process. It was distributed on the eMaryland marketplace as well as many public art listservs, and including eBlast and all the traditional marketing that we do in getting the word out. For this particular project, because it's over $500,000, we were looking at artists that had experience with budgets and projects of at least $175,000. That was the eligibility. Now, on the Maryland front, we have not had public art programs for very long, and so our Maryland artists are getting up to speed in their competitiveness for qualifying for these eligibility requirements. We're proud that 4 of them came to the top and were reviewed very closely by our panel. We are also working on professional development to help our artists be more competitive in these processes. We also want to note that our artists, we want them to be able to compete in other states. If we limit our calls, this in turn could limit Maryland artists' ability to apply for public art calls outside the state. And so the standard best practice, as with architecture and engineering, is to open it up beyond state lines. And this was the most qualified artist.
Sure, but you've just exactly articulated why I'm concerned. Your RFP obviously kept out most Maryland artists because we don't have a lot that have done $175,000 projects. There's no reason why you couldn't have done more outreach and brought everybody in under, particularly, you say you serve on the State Art Council. I mean, this is odd that you are supporting a system and a decision that came up with a Florida-based vendor, and you say that we have a fledgling artist community. I didn't realize it was fledgling. I think it's one of the best in the country.
For public art, in particular, this this aligns with architecture and engineering procurement?
Well, it's exactly what I have always been concerned about with the state's procurement process, which is you pick the winners and losers in your RFP. And you have an explanation which doesn't make sense to me. If you have a good artist, why can't they do a $500,000 contract, particularly if they're in Maryland?
For the particular LEED requirements of this building, we're looking for LEED Platinum. This artist had those qualifications. And the
what does that have to do with it?
The public artwork itself will help fulfill the LEED sustainability components of the building. That was one of the outstanding features of the particular artist who was selected.
Is that the material they use or
the materials and supporting the wind vanes and green roofs and recycling stormwater, all of that this artist has experience with. And that was, in particular, why they were chosen.
Can you describe in 1 minute the sort of artwork you're talking about?
Yeah.
The artist is creating a work that will be integrated into the exterior landscape of the building. And the artist sometimes is overlapping into the territory of landscape architecture. The artist has particular experience with that infrastructure work and coming in now to work with the architect and the general contractor right now because the building's under construction to ensure that that artwork, that water feature that's utilizing the LEED features, the stormwater management components, will be met. The artist needs to start the design process. The artists were not selected according to a proposal. Just like in an architecture project, we hire the client, then they design the building. Here, they design the artwork.
So this is not like some of the jurisdictions have had art set-asides, or at least used to.
Yes.
Set-aside for art in public places.
Yes.
For a long time.
Yes.
I was saying, Marianne Mears, a great sculptor from mm-hmm. Maryland, in next to Imagination Stage in Bethesda, where we've all been, had a variety of things. This is something different.
Actually, it's a similar process. Montgomery County, Prince George's, the Purple Line have all selected artists from a national base. So we're aligning with public art best practices nationally.
Any of those picked from Maryland?
Yes, actually some of them have been
Maryland
artists. But it is a national call for those county public art projects as well.
But I guess what I'm thinking of is what she did in Bethesda, or actually Shady Grove too, were more pieces of art. They weren't integrated
into
the environment, as you're
correct.
Saying.
And we were looking at integrated work because of the scale of this project and the opportunity with a LEED building to actually serve as a model for a public artwork that is integrating LEED standards. We're looking at this artist, this artwork becoming a destination because that artist is so well known. They will want to come see this site.
Make sure you have a big sign saying they're from Florida.
That we only list the artist's name.
Seriously, because, you know, I can't believe you aren't more bullish as far as the Maryland art community. I mean, this is crazy.
They came up to the plate with their strongest proposal. This was the selection process that we utilized. And again, we are looking at the professional development of art Maryland artists. So.
All right.
Any further questions?
I'd like this item pulled out if I could. And when we vote.
Yep, that one. That is the fourth listing in item one.
Thank you. Are you in agreement to?
I'd support this. I mean, I do agree in supporting the Maryland arts community, always have, personally, and in the legislature and as treasurer. Mr. Singer is truly outstanding, and I think it is different from the people I've talked to in our arts community. This is what they want to build here, but this isn't what they have. this wasn't what the strength was. That's my understanding.
With interstate commerce laws, we are not limiting the calls according
to region.
That's not a question of
limiting to Maryland. The question was, if you put out the call in Maryland, why was there not more response? And the what I have heard when I made these inquiries from folks was that this was going into an area that was somewhat new, not just in Maryland, in general. And while they wanted to go in that direction, this was not where they had been. Is that wrong? I mean,
we were aligning with national public art programs of other states. Yes, it was a new program to integrate public art in state buildings. We have not. We're only on our fourth project, and we are absolutely going for the best possible work. And through the selection process, this was the artist that was selected. We had.
I'm sorry, that's very subjective.
Okay. I'm sorry if I misunderstood your question. The artwork is essentially part of the landscape architecture, and the artwork will be a water feature. It's part of the landscape. It's part of a wetland, actually. So this artist had very specific qualifications.
And
that
this
meant
was
that.
What was set out in the call. That this was
correct.
The sort of thing. That
correct.
That was my understanding
okay.
from talking to friends and the community.
Correct. I'm sorry if I'm misreading.
Thank you.
Okay. I understand your concern, but I'm inclined to let it go through. I think this, you know, I didn't know about the detail until now. It's something that is integrated into the building and the design. And so it's, I mean, my limited understanding of art, I was thinking of a portrait of William Donald Schaefer up there. But this is something
or
more.
Even
or even Bob Berlick, or Calvert. But, so I'm inclined to let it go through as well. Any other questions on university system?
So I'd like to have a vote on this.
We can vote on this one item separately. And, we have a motion for this item, the fifth item down, I guess it is. For Shady
Grove. University of Shady Grove Biomedical Educational Facility.
Okay. I would move a favorable on the Shady Grove project.
Okay. One opposed?
One opposed.
And two supporting. And then for the other, we have a motion for the, I can move for the remainder. We have a second.
Let me just comment that most of these contracts I still see are manager risk or whatever the term is. I continue to think that this is a boondoggle for the state taxpayers. I hope that I'm still around when we get rid of most of these sweetheart deals with these big companies, paying them tens of millions of dollars for doing essentially scheduling, as far as I can tell, and no construction themselves. And we don't do it with our own state buildings, university system. Almost every one of these projects, except for one, is done through this mistake, I think, of a bidding system. And I know it's convenient for the university system, but it's terrible for the taxpayers. And I only bring that up to say I'm not voting against all these things because it will just take too much time, but I hope someday that I'm around on this board when these things are very rare. Thank you.
So we have a motion on the remainder. Second.
Thank you.
I think we approve. Okay.
Thank you.
Department of Information Technology. Good
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Michael Leahy, Secretary of the Department of Information Technology. Today we have 10 items on the agenda. One is hand carried, and I do have agency representatives here to answer any questions you may have.
I just want to ask a question of the Secretary.
Yes, Mr. Comptroller.
You know, and at the next meeting, we're going to talk about procurement reform proposals,
sir.
And one of them is going to be to expand this concept of allowing agencies to have more contracts in a system that allows them not to bring those contracts to the Board of Public Works.
Master contract.
Master contract.
Yes, sir. Oh, okay.
And I believe a couple of meetings ago, we approved, I'm not sure why it got before us, but I think it was a $50 million plus item from a master contract. I'm not sure we had to approve it or whether it was just there.
Well, which one? I'm sorry.
My concern is, I understand we gave, the legislature and the board has given you a master contract capability, but now expanding it to other agencies, for me, is something that I want to take a look at.
Sure.
And I think recently you had a contract of $50 million plus that I don't think got a vote on the board, but you nicely brought it to our attention, but you didn't have to.
Yes, sir.
And I think that's pretty...
Well, if I may, Mr.
Yeah,
Comptroller,
please, go ahead.
The items that are included in that contract are specifically IT-based items. And because we are taking the business processes and the workflows from the various agencies and implementing the technology applications, that's why it's going to the other agencies. It is still all IT work. It is still all within the purview of us managing those contracts under either the MITDP funds or the CATS Plus program. So look forward to talking to you about it, and if there's any preliminary questions, we'd be happy to get you answers on them.
Yeah, no, I bring it up not as that I'm concerned about the proposals to expand it.
Sure.
I'm skeptical and would like to be assured that we're not going to see a proliferation of contracts being entered into that
right.
The board has traditionally been reviewing.
Yeah, no, that is certainly not the intent, and to the extent we can discuss that to allay your fears, very happy to.
Thank you.
I just wanted to point out that information technology has had this ability to do master contracts for a while, which is why you have seen these CATS contracts in front of you. What did happen is the legislature has expanded that and said many other agencies can now use that method. That, I just want to point out, was it Secretary item 2 that we reviewed today. That's the regulatory process
right.
to which the comptroller is referring that we will be bringing back at a later meeting. And so we will explore with all the agencies. Not
right,
just
but it's a may, not a shall.
Absolutely, no.
Right.
Yes, we
right.
and we will clarify on that. But that's what will come back from Secretary 2. We will have another item on all those regulatory proposals.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for information technology? Okay, and a second, and we're approved.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. We have Department of Transportation.
Good morning, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller.
You want to wait just a moment?
Okay.
We'll let people clear out. Gentleman who wants to speak.
Good morning, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, Governor. For the record, my name is Jim Forts. I'm Deputy Secretary for Maryland Department of Transportation. The Maryland Department of Transportation is presenting 47 items today.
Ding, ding. You get the big one.
We get the award.
Yeah.
I couldn't stop smiling because I saw the treasurer start smiling at me. I started to lose it there. I'm sorry. But items 46 and 47 were submitted as supplemental items, and items 11M and 38E are being withdrawn. Mr. Comptroller, you'll be happy to know that MDOT is absolutely enthusiastic that we have a robust art display, Maryland's art at BWI, that the First Lady, Yumi Hogan, is extremely involved in, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay.
And it was pretty inexpensive, right?
Yeah, it cost us nothing.
We
spent time to put up the frames.
Okay. Item number one, and we have someone here to speak. Is it Jorge Tirigo? Sir? Good morning.
Good morning, Lieutenant Governor, Treasurer, and Comptroller. My name is Jorge Tirigo. I am the autistic son of Luis Tirigal, one of the leaders of the BWI Airport Taxi Coalition. I'm also the descendant of Jose Marzano, a great hero to Jose San Martin, the founding father of Argentina and Peru. I'm here today, coming from Columbia, Maryland, to talk to you about the information technology contract. I find that this contract is not a threat to the cab driver bill of rights that my father proposed to you a few weeks ago. And I simply find it easy to believe that these technological updates must be consistent. As a mouse, we must keep up with the technological updates. That's why I simply believe that the information technology contract would not only give the benefit not only to cab drivers like my father, but also it would give the benefit to the customers who would enter the airport. I've read over the contract, and I just thought about it. I said, yeah, it was great. So I just decided that I would be here in honor of my father and his organization that has stood here in this room for the past few weeks in front of you guys. Oh. So I'm doing the same that my father did to you into my presence. And I hope you can accept the fact that the technological information contract, which is under the association of the taxi companies, will not make a direct threat to the cab driver bill of rights, because it does not violate the cab driver's personal liberty and freedom in the airports. So I would advise you to pass this bill, and we'll see how it goes from here.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your coming in and stating the case in support of this item. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rutherford.
I don't have a question on 6AE, but I do want to make a point that I'm glad to see that it's an engineering project put in the Small Business Reserve Program. And I saw a number of other transportation items that are in Small Business Reserve, and so I appreciate that and continue to encourage more agencies to utilize the Small Business Reserve Program. I do have a state highway question, 40 real estate, RP. I think I understand it, but the appraisal was low appraisal, $600,000. We're going to actually dispose of the property for $300,000. Is that an access issue? Is that?
It is. Go ahead, Olu. It is an access issue.
Okay.
Good morning. My name is Olu Okunola. I'm with the Maryland State Highway Administration. Mm-hmm. The value for the access is actually the cost to grant direct access onto Maryland Route 22.
Okay.
So that is basically the offset in cost.
Okay, so it would cost another, I think it's at $275,000 or so, or $325,000. And are they putting in a circle or traffic signal?
They're installing a traffic signal, and they are also installing a left turn lane to access the site.
Okay, so the owner is putting this in, yes. And so that offsets the value of the property.
Exactly.
Okay, I just wanted to confirm that. Yeah, I just was confirming that. Is Ms. Georgia Peak here, by any chance? She's not here. I was going to recognize her because I understand she's retiring. So, and I did some work with her before I came into this job, and so I just wanted to recognize her. So pass it on to her, if she hadn't already left.
She's actually at MBA, but we will definitely pass it on.
I thought she was at State Highway when I
was. She was. Now she transferred to MBA.
But okay.
I'll make sure she gets the message.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Could I ask a question, Jim?
Sure.
There are a couple of items. I just want to make sure I understand that the emergency braking, the railroad braking contracts, I understand there's a deadline of the end of the year. Can you just explain how these all fit together? I read them all very quickly.
You're talking about Amtrak?
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
It's,
well,
so,
Mark, I mean, basically, but
well,
yes.
Well, it is Mark,
Amtrak,
but it's on the Amtrak line,
yeah.
Yes. So the Penn line.
Yeah.
So it's Amtrak. Amtrak owns the rail. Mm-hmm. So as you may know, Amtrak and CSX are sometimes a little difficult to deal with, and negotiations with them is somewhat strained. Amtrak, as you know, we had an agreement for liability. And Amtrak wanted the liability to ship more to us. And all their other contracts up and down the Northeast Corridor shifted to the $4. Okay? Four. In other words, I'm sorry, it's but four. So the but four language in liability is that but for the reason that you were here, this accident or crash would not have happened. And Pete Ron stood firm because he understood the comptroller for sure, and others in the Board of Public Works did not like the but-for language. And when we stood our ground to Amtrak and said we would not take another agreement to the Board of Public Works because we do not want to give up that but-for language, the new CEO said, okay, we are not going to sign the contract for maintenance, and we are not going to sign our new agreement. And went like that. So that got our attention. And
as it was meant to.
And the bottom line is, they're tracks. We lease them. So we really had no leverage whatsoever. It was a very contentious meeting. Everybody left mad. And so we had a decision to make, so we had to give up that but-for language like everybody else on the East Coast. And then they agreed to sign the maintenance contract as well as the lease agreement. And so obviously we were going to have it on the previous agenda, but the previous meeting was canceled. And so we're kind of at the end of this rope on this one because as of July 1st, if it doesn't pass, we don't have a contract with them. That's kind of the good, bad, and ugly of the entire issue.
Okay. And if it does pass, then we are in sync with everyone else,
correct.
Essentially.
That's correct. Okay. And they also sued us, and we're working out through the court. I mean, there's a lot more to it, but I don't want to get into it here. We'll be glad to brief you later.
The substance of the systems made the press with the Amtrak accidents going up the Northeast Corridor, and folks read that. We don't want to be in a situation like that.
No,
so if this is what it takes, and it saves us from being in that situation, I would think it's a good thing.
That's what we had to do.
It's an acceptable thing. Thanks.
Sure.
Any other questions?
Yes, item 12. So this is a pest control contract, and I understand the pest control industry in Maryland is pretty well established, so I'm wondering why we ended up with a procurement where there's just one bid.
Okay. So let me explain this in the context of 12 and 13, okay? Because 13, you'll notice that we have pest control. So what we did is we broke up the big, well, we used to do it by credit card, but then we tried to break it down so we could utilize small business reserve. And by doing so, what we recognize is that the small businesses could handle certain portions of the pest control, you know, for like light rail and metro, but the bus stuff is just too big for them. And so and essentially, by breaking it up, all the small businesses and all the other competitors went and bid on those, but didn't feel like they could bid on this one. Now, we did have two bidders on this contract. Unfortunately, the one bidder did not fill out the MBE correctly, and as you know, that's not durable. And so we had to throw them out, which left this other bidder, which can handle the work.
Excuse me just a second. Sheila, didn't we talk about curing that?
Yes, and I believe the procurement advisor is working.
We're still working on that regulation.
That
okay. All right.
But I know that one issue before was small business reserves having the MBE on them back
years ago. So, as I mentioned, we're listening, mm-hmm. and we're trying to do as much as we can with the small business reserve. But then what happens is there becomes this, I guess, line where they can't handle it, and we have to move it out.
The smaller pest companies.
Okay.
But don't we have a rather large number of
pest
control companies?
We did, and we solicited 236 vendors.
Yeah. This, with all due respect, I've heard it. It's like a drumbeat. Every time you raise your question about a single bid, we talk about e-market marketplace or something like that, and 232 people were solicited. The result is still the same. One bid.
Did you get reasons why some of these others? Because I know what we've heard in many cases is our contract terms, which we're working through now, terms and conditions put a tremendous amount of liability on the vendor. And so, I mean, if you're in the pest control business, you're dealing with toxic chemicals.
You got a lot of liability.
And so, you know, the fact that we don't even use the term reasonable in many cases. We don't say reasonable, you know, errors or they should have taken reasonable steps. So, I don't know. Introduce yourself.
And Joe.
Hi, my name is Joe Setatal. I'm the Deputy Director of Procurement at the MTA. Regarding this particular contract, and to your point, Comptroller, regarding like the Terminexes, the Orkins of the world that mm-hmm. didn't bid, we were in communication with them. And as the agenda item notes, there was an emergency contract prior to this that we had put out where we had communication with some of these vendors as well. And at the end of the day, despite multiple direct communication, not like you're talking about, not the e-Maryland marketplace notices, but actually picking up the phone and calling them, at the end of the day, they didn't want to bid. They didn't want the contract. I know it's really hard to believe that why wouldn't you want an $800,000, $1 million contract to do this? But we had multiple conversations. There was some conversation during the emergency procurement, well, the emergency report that we did regarding the actual scope, much like you're talking about, Lieutenant Governor, and Terminex wasn't interested. They wanted to change a lot of things, and we understood exactly what we needed.
Changing things like what?
I think just kind of process of how they actually wanted to go about doing the sprays, how often.
Okay, so they weren't talking about our terms and conditions.
I don't think it was contractual, no.
Okay.
I think it was more the true scope of the work. But, again, we did reach out to them, and we did have direct conversation with them. But they...
Was there a single reason these other competitors didn't bid, or was it unique to each of the companies? And I don't really understand what their objection was to bidding on a contract.
Yeah. Well, I know one of them, we did a follow-up, and we actually said, hey, why didn't you bid? Mm-hmm. No response. And we can follow up multiple times, but at the end of the day, we didn't get a response for an actual reason. I believe one of them, I think it was Forkin, actually showed up at our pre-bid and then did not submit a bid. So, I mean, this is certainly something that we can look forward to and take this as a learning experience, but if a we can't make a company bid, and one of the things that I think is really important that Deputy Secretary was talking about earlier is we did want to break this up into these small business reserves. And I think we're not really having this conversation even if we had kept this as a combined contract with multiple functional areas. But with the SBR program, we're not able to do that. So in an effort to provide some contracts to the small business reserve program, we ended up with a single bid on this large portion.
You know, I know that you guys are busy, but I think, I mean, the comptroller's making a very good point. I would be curious if you all could go back and ask these the big vendors, you know, why was it that you decided not to bid on this project? Is it too small? Is it you're too busy? You don't like us? You know, what are the reasons? I'd want to know why is it that they're not bidding. I don't want to think that they're saying, hey, we would have done both, but we don't want to do one. You know, we would have.
We do get that, and we get that with our lighting contracts.
Unless, I guess, they're saying it's too small.
Some of them,
This is too small for the big guys, but too big for the small guys?
Well, and for example, like at SHA, with the lighting contracts, nobody wants to do maintenance. They all want to do the installations. Mm-hmm. So now we can't get people to do the maintenance because it's too small. And
the
it's
little
a
guys can't do the
it's
maintenance.
It's a onesie and a twosie. It's a, you know, it's, you're not out there doing, you know, 50 or 60 new light bulbs. I mean, there's a lot of different reasons that businesses make those business decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But we can reach out again.
We can get the information.
We all find out.
All right.
Yeah, you know, out in the hustings, I ballyhoo the fact that the Board of Public Works has significantly reduced single bid awards and why that's good for the consumers and the taxpayers. And in 2013, there were 82 single bids approved by this board. New administration dropped down to 64 in 2014, 39 in 2015, to 29 in 2016. Unbelievable. Well, last year, creeped back up to 38. This year, we've done 11 already, and with this agenda, we're adding 3, so that's 14. So the deep state, so to speak, whatever it is, creeps back in. And I don't know of any other solution other than just say no and go out, go back, and not only interrogate your folks that didn't bid the first time, but figure it out. Do a better job of generating competition, particularly in an area like pest control, which there are a lot of them. And so I'm, you know, with respect, I'm going to vote no, because that's the only thing that really works, in my humble opinion. And in this one, I think we can, you know, perhaps plant the flag, if one of my colleagues cares to join me. But
all right.
Went down, now it's coming back up again. And the public loves the fact that we are tough on competition, that we want approved. We want two competitive bids. And so I don't know. That's just a shout to the wilderness. If the agency could do a better job, I would be grateful. If the board wants to approve it, obviously that's my colleague's
decision.
Again,
I want to stress that we did have two bids. We did have two, but they filled out the paperwork incorrectly, and it's not curable.
Right.
Now, if we can fix the procurement process.
Right, but we can't cure it in time.
But I can't do it now.
Yeah.
Well, we got to follow the law.
If I can add one other thing to your point, I mean, I think we're all in agreement that one of the real benefits of a competitive bidding process is lower prices from taxpayer. And by engaging in this competitive process, we did see a competitive price from the awardee.
What was the price last year? Can you remember?
So the emergency...
The previous five-year contract?
So in the past with pest control, we haven't had these sort of long-term contracts.
Oh, okay.
We were doing it more on an as-needed basis. What we did find is in the emergency contract that was awarded to Home Paramount for the entire system, the prices are significantly lower on a line-item basis for this contract. And I think that can largely be attributable to the competitive process that we went through.
Again, I understand the comptroller's concern. I'm willing to let it go through, but I do want to get, if you all are going to follow up, I'd like to get a report, Mrs. Zimmerman, back from what you all find out from these vendors, why they didn't compete. My concern, Mr. Comptroller, is that we'll have all the bugs and rodents in the buses, you know, starting on the 18th, they'll come back if we don't. If people don't eat on the buses, we're probably fine, but people do, unfortunately, eat on the buses. When I used to take the old Metro bus in D.C., I used to eat on it, even though I wasn't supposed to. I have to have the pest control. But I was a teenager at the time.
D.C. Transit.
D.C. Transit, yes. I remember that, too. Okay.
Went bankrupt.
Any other? And Metro took it all. Any other questions?
Item 18.
Mr. Comptroller, may I just have a moment to say that you're not away from the wilderness. I actually have in my notes that 1 year ago, exactly, on the July 2017 meeting, we at that point had 24 single bids, and you called it out, just like you did now. You said, keep the single bids down to 30 a year. And guess what happened? Apparently in the next 6 months, they only got six because you just told me there were only 30 in 2017. So, actually, I think that people do hear, and you're saying it again today, and re-emphasizing what you did a year ago. But I want to point out that you told them 1 year ago, keep it down to 30 for the rest of the year, and they did.
Good. Thank you. Feel much better. So, item 18, if I could, Lieutenant Governor.
Yeah.
This is a contract that the board unanimously rejected last August. That's fairly rare for the board to unanimously reject a contract. Can't think of many others during my tenure here. But we were being asked 10 months ago to approve the same contract with the same vendor after the MTA decided to forego a competitive procurement process and award this contract to the incumbent Coachworks. It's a $1.19 million contract for sole source contract for structural repairs to light rail passenger trains. So I guess my first question is, why is it so hard to get a competitive solicitation? And secondly, what if, God forbid, this company ever went out of business? How would we take care of the maintenance?
So I believe that a big part of the reason for the previous decision by the board had a lot to do with the graphics.
The what?
The cleanup of the graphics. And we removed that. And we competitively did that part out. This portion here, as you can imagine, is a niche market. Part of the challenge with this is we can't pick these light rail cars up and take them to a shop. A repair shop. The repair shop basically has to come to us. And this company is one of the few that can do machining of parts on the spot to get these light rail vehicles back up and running. So it is a niche market, as you can imagine. It's not like everybody wants to do light rail repair and has the ability to machine parts for you and, again, basically bring their shop to you, not vice versa. So it's a little bit more of a challenge. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, and Joe, correct me if I'm wrong, but the previous vendor that we had a while back actually ended up using this group as a sub to do the work.
So we're going to be
firms out there.
I take it we or someone's going to be dependent upon Coachworks for...
Unless another one comes
long
out.
Time.
So, to his point, yes, we did reach out to the vendor that had this contract prior, which was around 2004, and they did come back to us and say they couldn't find anyone to do the work. Also, to his point, this is highly technical. One of the kind of niche aspects of it is that these are, in a lot of cases, older trains, and with regards to the structural repair, there are certain pieces and parts that need to be reconstructed that can't just be got.
Machines.
machine. And so we actually, this vendor is able to come in machine now. To your point regarding the dependency and the market, I cannot speak to that. I can hope that the market will find a way to, in the future, create more opportunities for us and allow us to competitively bid this in the future. But at the moment, there is one individual that can provide this work, and I think that without a doubt, this does meet the definition of a sole source. One other thing to kind of just keep in mind is we were able to, through the negotiation process with this vendor, able to get the pricing that they offered us in 2009. So we got a good deal, which I think is nice.
Where is Coach Works, their parent? You know, LLC is probably
Baltimore, Maryland.
Where's their parent? They have a parent. They're an LLC. This is probably some unit of some larger conglomerate.
They're a very small shop. It's,
oh, really? It's not a part of...
It's an individual.
Siemens or something like that?
No, sir.
Why don't we hire the individual?
That's a great question. And if we can get more pins, we'll do that.
Run this under... This is your transportation trust fund. Use one of your vacancies.
We do.
All right.
Okay, so if I could get item 12 and the
pest
pulled out and we vote no.
On 12 and
18. I think you guys understand where I'm coming from. We're just not going to cultivate more vendors and more competition if we keep falling back on, you know, from your standpoint, it's a good deal. From my standpoint, we need competition.
Totally understood.
I know it's not easy.
So we have a motion to vote on 18 and 12 separately.
Could I just say, I'm going to vote for these projects. I do believe that we should reduce sole source. We've raised this before. On the other hand, I don't like the idea of the rats on the bus. So I think you have to look at the practical implications.
And I will echo those comments. And we'll, you know, I do want to see why we're not getting the competition, and particularly on that pest control one. It is troubling on the Coach Works for a number of points, and I don't know if it's just the fact that our vehicles, trains are so outdated, because I would think there are other areas that have light rail trolley type of transit going on. Is it that they are newer equipment than we do, or?
Well, normally, with a rail vehicle, in this case, they're good for about 30 years. It's a 15-year overhaul. Right. So after 15 years, you do a complete overhaul. It's practically a brand-new vehicle again, and then you bring it out for another 15 years. After that, you pretty much get rid of them. And that's what Mod is going through. Theirs are about 30 years old now, so they're getting newer ones. And then when ours turn 30, we will look to get new ones.
All right. So that was a 2-1 on those two items.
12 and 18.
The other, the motion for the remainder? Okay. All smooth. Department of General Services.
Well, good afternoon, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Ellington Churchill, Secretary for the Department of General Services. Thank you. The department has 54 items on our agenda.
You're going for the whole state with one department.
Including one, Aunt Carrie. We're drawing six items. Item 1, 19, 20, 34, 37, and 39. Still leaving 48 items for review.
All right. All right. Came back down.
I will not mention our...
Did you say 34?
I said 1, 19, 20, 34,
okay.
37, and 39.
Okay.
Correct?
Yep, yep.
Correct?
Correct.
And I will not mention our success in terms of artwork or multiple bids. I will not. But we are happy to answer any questions that you have at this time.
Okay. You've withdrawn the marble steps claim. Okay. I have a question on 29, the lease with Human Services. And I know this is the facility right down the street. $32 a square foot, and I know Annapolis is high, but is it possible to go further up, you know, up Main Street or further up? Do you have to be in that location?
Well, I'll let Jane Roger or Robert Suit from our real estate department talk about the general area.
Yeah, did they look a little?
Yeah, Robert has all the facts and figures on the Annapolis marketplace.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Robert Suit. I'm the Chief Lease Management here in the Department of General Services. Your question is relative to...
I am 29 LT. It's the Child Support Enforcement Administration office, five-year lease, and an annual rent of over $600,000.
And, Robert, I believe the question was going outside the area that was identified. Would that have generated a lower lease rate?
I know they've had a long presence in the facility and in close proximity to the court. The employees that work there, if there was in walking distance.
Okay, so the court is the big issue.
Yes, sir.
It just seems, I mean, maybe if they weren't on the main street, but I guess you got the transit question, but, I mean, was there a solicitation? Did you actually survey?
No. Well.
No. Okay.
I think the prevailing rate for full service in Annapolis is about $28, $29, which is slightly above that. But I know in addition to that, the agency receives grant money to pay for some of the services in this facility, and they also have a presence in one of the county-owned spaces for which we don't pay rent down on River Road.
I mean, we were just talking about competition, and you said you didn't even do a survey.
And so this was treated as a sole source with the renewal.
I have a problem with this. I mean, it stuck out to me just in terms of the price. And now I almost wish you had lied to me and told me or just not even, you know, added that additional information. This might be me voting against our own item because I think it should have been at least a survey. I mean, at $29 or $28, this is a substantial saving on 18,000 square feet. You know, $1 or $2 off a square foot is substantial. So I don't like that one at all.
What would you like to do?
I don't want to approve it. I would like that you guys go back out. You may need to get a short-term extension on the contract because it seems like it takes effect. It's again, you know, in 2 weeks it takes effect. So the lease is expiring. This is 29. The lease is expiring, right?
We'll hold over.
We do have some.
You have a holdover.
Holdover will expire at the end of the month.
The holdover will expire at the end of the month, so we'll likely come. We'll have to come back and.
Okay, So
while
come
we
back
work this
and
out.
Go out with a survey and see what you can do in terms of space at a different price.
Yes.
Unless they overrule me.
I just want to make sure I understand. You're talking about the child support office, right? I just want to make sure I understand what's going to happen operationally.
No one's going to get kicked out of there.
Well, I think depending on if they wind up at another location, the additional costs that they would incur as far as transportation and parking.
Well, there's no parking there now.
Now, is there, but the,
there's a lot behind there.
No, I understand. But when the employees at the present location, they already have parking.
I mean, I'm concerned about state employees, but I'm more concerned about the people who are going there. So there's no parking now at that corner. You know, there is a cost, but when we're talking about a dollar difference is $18,000 a year over 5 years.
So I just want to understand.
You're asking about the program, program
what
function.
Actually, what's going to happen? Yeah.
Do we have anyone from the program here, Robert?
This is an important program. There's a reason for it to be near the courthouse. On the other hand, it is a high cost. It has public access. I just want to make sure the program.
It could be a block away,
and
it could be maybe a dollar cheaper.
If it's possible to be a block away and cheaper, and the cost of moving is still a net savings, that's swell. I just would like to
understand
what happens now in the next 3 months.
Madam Treasurer, I don't have the specifics on the program within the facility presently.
I think she's asking, are they going to have to move in 3 months?
Yeah.
We're going to have to brief the board on what's going to happen with the department.
Just withdraw the
DGF, yeah. You're
yeah.
just
yeah.
right.
We
can
bring it back the next time or explore.
Yes.
Explore.
You do your survey. They don't have to go anywhere. They don't have to do a thing.
Mm-hmm.
You do the survey to see what the rates are, what you can possibly get someplace else, and then you make a determination in terms of whether that is the lease worth taking versus the lease that we're currently in.
And meanwhile, you hold it over the July, after July.
Right, they're not kicked out. They're not going to be throwing their stuff out on the street.
We have a number of options.
Coming in.
Sheriff's
not going to evict them.
We have a number of options. Everyone understands, of course, that the lease term will expire, and so we'll have to use the options that are available to us to extend the current
I can go with this as long as the operations aren't impaired, the public is not impaired. You're just looking to see whether you can get something cheaper that's equally net cheaper that's equally convenient.
It's a small extension, and the department can withdraw item 29. We'll go back and get more information for the board.
Nothing happens internally. This is all DGS and us making sure that it's worthwhile.
Yeah, even if there is some disruption, it's not too bad to encourage the tight-with-a-dollar tendencies of the lieutenant governor, and I applaud him for bringing this up and moving it. The secretary obviously can pay attention to this. And it's a good way to end this Board of Public Works meeting. Although I do have one item.
That's it. Yeah. One more, too.
I just wanted to quickly, Lieutenant Governor, if I could, ask Mr. Rowe, the Executive Director of Channel Marker Foundation, to come up and tell us a little bit about his program. I visited it in Easton. It provides a wide range of mental health services and rehabilitation to individuals and their families. And I was very impressed with it and just would like to have Mr. Rowe perhaps share with us a little bit about his fantastic organization.
Thank you, Mr. Comptroller and Mr. Lieutenant Governor and Madam Treasurer. I'm Talbert Rao. I am the volunteer executive director of Channel Marker Foundation, which actually owns real estate that provides mental health services to Channel Marker, Inc.
And this is item 52.
Correct. Yes, sir, for our satisfaction of the right of recovery. But to speak a little bit to what you have brought up, Mr. Comptroller, is the mission of what Channel Marker does is provides mental health services, obviously, to a large population. I would like to yield a little bit, if I could, to Kathy Castle, who is our clinical director, basically, with Channel Marker. She is here in lieu of Debbie Jackson, who you've met. Don't know if you're aware, but she began chemotherapy last week. So we would ask, prayers for Debbie, who's been very, very integral in what we're doing and the services that we provide. I basically have been worked primarily on the foundation side, which has the real estate that basically provides, the land, the properties, the facilities that Channel Marker uses. Kathy's going to be is a lot more versed in explaining maybe a little bit more of the specifics in our population that we serve. If that's okay with
you. If you could just briefly give a few highlights.
And we'll also say Mr. John McQuaid, who is the president volunteer of Channel Marker, Inc., also is here.
And you're on the Eastern Shore.
Yes, sir. Based in Easton. And our request today specifically, just to outline that, is to shift the right of recovery from our previous facility that was located on Port Street in the amount of $427,000. It was a grant issued back in March of 1989 with that property. It expires in March of 2019, but we are now have moved into a new facility that you have obviously seen, and we are seeking to sell that property, and our reason for being here is to have that shifted from the property located at Port Street to the one on Glee Park Drive. So I'll yield to Kathy briefly.
Thanks for having us here. Comptroller, we've seen you a couple times at both of those facilities. What we do, we're a safety net provider of mental health services, like a lot of providers in Maryland. And we provide our services in the community. We work with Medicaid recipients, mostly, that have a chronic severe mental illness, and trying to keep people out of the emergency departments and higher level of care and inpatient. And it's tough work. We appreciate the administration. You guys have supported the HOPE Act of 2017, which allowed for us to have some increase, much-needed increases to our rates for the next couple years, and we appreciate that, just the support. Behavioral health is sometimes forgotten, and as we know, there's a lot of suicide, opioid, abuse, and we're all trying to tackle those together.
Yep.
Thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you.
I just want to recognize very quickly, relating to item 44 CGL, is Sam Wallace here? Any chance? Sam, can you stand up, please? I want to recognize Sam Wallace. He's about to go into the U.S. Marine Corps Officer Candidate School, and I want to thank you for your service, and thank you for, the commitment that you're making on behalf of all of us.
Yes, that's withdrawn. In addition to all the ones he named at the beginning, we have also added the 29th lease item for the DHS local social
right.
service.
Okay.
Second. Okay. DHR, sorry.
What's that?
At West Street.
We have a second. We're all in favor. Thank you.
Thank you.